This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I'm a huge Viola Spolin fan, so when I teach, I use a lot of her exercises, as many teachers do, although some teachers don't even know that they're using her exercises because she's kind of been not erased from improv history, but I'm always surprised how many students or actors that I've worked with that are rooted in improv have not heard of her.
Well, there's not a lot of sort of history available. You know what I mean? Like there at this point, I'm finding when I talk to people that, you know, they're receiving improv from each other. Like there's a leader who shows up and says, hey, I'm going to do this. And then they follow the leader, or they are going online and finding things and, you know, mirroring that sort of stuff, whether it's a television show or somebody who is actually showing an improv exercise online. And then because I'm going to be honest with you, my entire education involved no reference to who created improv or how it got started or like what the first group was. You know, I don't know that every improv school either knows it or finds the history of it important. You know what I mean? I mean, I totally,
I feel
since
like it
then,
is important. And I try to, in my beginning classes, at least, I try to, insert that a little bit just because I think it's a pretty cool history. It's interesting that not a lot of people, I think you're right that it's just kind of, I mean, it's word of mouth and there's a lot of people that just don't know it because they weren't taught it. And then it's just gotten kind of forgotten in a way. So I'm trying to bring it back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, honest to goodness, if I personally have been trying to get the information, honestly, through a lot of these interviews, like just talk to people about like where they learned it and how, what was the first book? So like I've had a few people make me like book lists, people who are like, yeah, I really think these are the important books to read. And I'm like, okay, yeah, let's give me that book list and I'll put it in the post with them. And it's like, it's to me, it's like, each person has their own like drive for what they're doing. And a lot of people, especially people who are like, who find that their passion is in the teaching of it, you know, will be like, this is all the things that you absolutely need to learn. Let me tell you right now. But I'm going to be honest, my improv upbringing was from an egotistical crowd. They were more interested in like getting famous than they were in doing any level of like true homage to the craft or the people who like began it or even the like ideas and groups that came together. So I've just been chatting with people and being like, oh, is that a thing? Okay. And then I like look it up and then I go a little further back in history and then I'll be like, okay, well, who taught this person? Okay. Well, who taught that person? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, Viola Spolin definitely seems to be the central character in most of it. Are there any other, imagine that I know nothing because I probably know nothing. What are other important improv historical figures you think that you present to your level one students that you think people really need to know?
I mean, Viola Spolin is always the first, in part too because she's a woman, and I don't think that a lot of women in improv get as much recognition because improv has sort of the reputation, and somewhat deservedly, of being just kind of a white guy's game, specifically a white 20-something man's thing. So I think it's empowering because a lot of times, I don't know if you have this experience, but a lot of times in my improv classes, it'll be dominated by women. Just the majority is girls or women. So I just want them to know that, hey, you're not alone and it's not weird. Keith Johnstone, as far as Canadian stuff goes, I mean, he's done a lot and he's heavily influenced like the European improv.
Yeah.
So they're doing a lot still. Narratively, I'm a huge narrative improv fan and person. So I was heavily influenced by my time in Seattle when I worked at Unexpected Productions. A little name drop there, with the artistic director there being Randy Dixon. So I did a lot of styles and genre and narrative work for the very first time. Whereas before, I had only done short form before I had moved out there. So that heavily influenced me. Yeah.
You know, I find a lot of people that start in short form will go towards narrative. And I wonder if it's just a drastic change from what they began with. You know how, like, naturally as humans, like, we do something and then once we kind of feel like we've done it, we're like, forget that. And we do, like, the exact opposite. Like I was going, like
that's
I was doing stage managing Shakespeare before I got into improv. And then I was just like, ugh, the opposite. What's not looking at a script and it being a super old script? Like,
That's so funny.
Yeah, I wonder.
Still do short form. I love short form.
Awesome.
I teach it because it's a great teaching tool.
Yep.
And I don't perform it as much as I perform long form, just because most of the short form that I'm doing when I'm performing it is like for corporate gigs or whatever, whereas I schedule more regular in front of audience shows. But
the best of the gigs.
I have done short form shows in front of audiences that weren't corporate people recently, but I still do more long form. But I like both. I feel like if I wasn't doing any long form at all, I would probably miss it sooner than I would if I wasn't doing any short form at all, just because I've done short form. I mean, I started performing over 25 years ago and I started doing short form. So I've been doing short form for a long time, but and then even when I'm not performing short form, I'm still teaching it. So I still get to like play with getting people to play it in a way where they are not letting the tail wag the dog, but they are actually being present and letting it teach them what they need to be taught.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's an interesting, and I feel like narratively, if you're good at narrative, it just makes your short form better too.
Yeah.
As well. Like you don't necessarily have to have a long hour or hour and a half long narrative performance to show narrative chops. I think you can show narrative chops even in like a 4-minute scene, hopefully. All things being ideal, of course.
Yeah, I mean, one hopes it's all just connecting ideas that literally any storytelling, whether it's narrative or random, is all just connecting ideas, you know. But at the same time, like, I find that narrative is more of an art. I feel, in my mind, like, doing a good narrative show is like doing a Herald that feels crisp. Like everything else is everything else, mostly. Like, the rest of the real, like, I find that everything else is just so wild and woolly and, like, just, and, like, if there isn't such a stark, crisp kind of format we're trying to achieve, then it's just like, what's the rabbit hole we're down? Let's keep swimming. It's crazy in here. Like, I don't know, We started with sneakers and then we were in Mars selling Froyo. What happened? I don't know. You know?
And I think, yes, if you have people that are narratively present and open to being like, we're going to do a narrative, that there is a certain amount of group mind, like there would be with a Herald, right? Where you're like, okay, we all have to be connected because we all have to know what would happen next. Like, not planning it, but just sort of knowing, just based on what we've done so far. So I think maybe that's part of it, where if people are just getting up and doing a mid-form kind of montage kind of thing, there is sort of like we're just improvising. We're not trying to make anything necessarily make sense.
So maybe that's part of it, where it's like it's setting up an expectation, right? It's like if I walk into a room and tell myself, I'm terrible with names, I'm not going to remember anybody's names. But if I walk into my new class of 18 students and I'm saying to myself, I'm going to remember everybody's names, I'm putting it an expectation on myself that I'm trying to live up to, so I'm going to be better at it. Whereas if I'm just like, we're just doing make-em-ups, maybe I'm not going to try to connect any characters back or connect any events to any other events and scenes, perhaps.
That's so interesting. I like the idea that it involves your own self-talk, that like you are part of the process of like, you know, whether or not your scene's going to go well involves you being literally open to the scene going well. Mm-hmm. Like that's really great. I'm more, I, in my mind, what I was thinking of was more of like, I'm like ethereal artist where it's like the natural flow of a story just happens once you're connected to the muse or whatever. Like, and I kind of feel that way about Harold. Like, I guess too, because like I found out what a Harold was not only after I did improv, but after I watched sitcoms my whole life. And then they were like, yeah, it's essentially sitcom format. And then it was just like, I heard a glass crash and I was like, oh, I understand. And forever, every comedy that I enjoyed my entire life was finally fit into a perfect box that I needed it. Remember I said I'm made out of spreadsheets? Right. That's me. So I was like, it makes sense. I love it so much more. Like, I don't know. As soon as I could like make it organized, then I was like, it's exactly what we're meant to do. That's why it's so perfectly aligned, you know. And between Harold and your natural narrative storytelling, where it's like, you know, something happens, it affects something else, you know, we deal with a problem, somebody goes through dealing with their conscience, you know, what am I going to do here? They make a decision one way or the other, and then we deal with what's the aftermath of that. You know, like the basic ideas of storytelling are also ingrained in us because we've been watching television and we've been reading books when we're tiny that like help us understand like the beginning, middle, and end of a story. And it's just sort of like who we are. That's why like I always think it's so interesting. I love a good narrative improv show because it's like I feel like I'm there and we're all together with the muse and I'm like, oh, it's happening.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, you brought up so many things in those three things.
I'm sorry, so many things.
And that one thing, I have three things. No. So I want to address all of them. One is when you were talking about muse, like being open to the muse. I guess it's just semantics, because in a way, I feel like if I'm talking about being open to, okay, I'm going to be open and present, and you're saying I'm going to be open so that the muse can flow through me, that my connection is that you are part of the muse.
Yeah.
Your muse is not without you. So it's kind of saying the same thing in a way.
Sure.
And then to talk about like shows being formatted to the Herald, especially Seinfeld, right? Like Seinfeld is legit. Like this is a formatted, structured Herald.
Yeah.
If we were to take an actual structured Herald of like the 1, 2, 3 ABC, that's Seinfeld, right? Like he's got his opening monologue and then he's got his closing monologue.
Yeah, I say that all the time. So it's so great.
Yeah. And then the third thing, when you were talking about being exposed to story at such a young age, I would say that even without storybooks and without shows and TV and movies, that just as humans, the way that we think is in story and the way that we communicate is in story. Like even when you first called me today, like we had an introduction, right? Of like, hey, this is our first time talking and these are things that you need to know. Like this is a phone interview and it can be weird. And like we have a setup and then we have that natural feeling of, okay, well now we need to get to it. So let's talk about this. Do you know what I mean? And then you feel the need to apologize of like, oh, I'm sorry, I have to go back to the introduction because I forgot one thing. Because as a storyteller, you need to know this beforehand.
Yeah, it's how my brain works.
It's how everyone's brain works, right? It's like we're human. So like we're all special, but nobody's special. But
yeah.
But Because I also teach storytelling, so I also teach personal storytelling classes. And the very first day of class, my first thing is, look, this isn't a class about how to teach you how to be a storyteller because you are already a storyteller. This is just how to give you a language and some a glossary of terms for a bunch of things that you're already doing. And then how can I help you craft your own unique style and get you telling a story in under 7 minutes? Because most like storytelling shows are usually like a 7 minute limit on stories.
Yeah.
But I feel like everybody's a storyteller. So it's just kind of letting people know, like, don't be in your head about it. Just go with your natural storytelling instinct, whether you're telling a personal story or you're in an improv show, or you're writing a sketch, right? Like, you already are a natural storyteller. You already know, when something should wrap up and what information you need to give for this joke to make sense, for example.
Yeah. It's so funny. We're such kindred spirits because you're describing what you open your storytelling. And I'm like, that sounds like my improv classes. I'm always opening with like, improv is your natural ability. You can do it. I'm just going to show you how to use it. And like,
it's so true.
It really is. I mean, it's literally like, you know, improv is like breathing. You can do it. It's just sometimes you do it in a way that constricts you. And sometimes you do it in a way that frees you. And I'm going to help you help it free you. And also maybe entertainment some people along the way. I could breathe and it could entertain people. It's called whistling. You know what I mean? Like, it's just.
Yeah,
we are who we are. I love that. That's so fun. Okay, so I feel like we've talked a lot about like teaching theory and you're like super cool and I'm very excited about it. But I want to hear more about your experience. You mentioned that you do improv to sketch when you teach your sketch classes because you had a basis knowledge in Second City. Now, first question, I guess, because I think I'm confused based on the research I did. Where are you currently located?
Oh my gosh. I'm a confusing person.
Well, I was just like, wait, I thought she was. And then, so.
I am outside of Atlanta. So I'm in the suburbs of Atlanta.
Great.
And I moved here for love. I met my husband in Chicago where I was teaching at Second City. And he's an academic. So pretty early into our relationship, I realized, oh man, we are in love, and he is not going to be living in Chicago for, you know, ever. So, but I told him, I was like, wherever you get a job, I can move anywhere because I do improv. So I've moved before. I've lived in a lot of cities. I can do what I do anywhere. I can either move to a place that already has improvisers and work with them, or I can move to a place that doesn't have improvisers or that doesn't think they have improvisers and teach a lot of classes and make them. And so, that's what happened. We got, he got a job as a professor in Georgia. So we are living in the South.
How long have you moved? How long have you lived there?
We've been here for 5 years now, which is crazy. I can't believe it. So it's been 5 years. And I love it. It's great. I don't like the weather because I'm like, when I lived in Seattle, like that was my perfect weather. Like that was my jam. So I feel
because
like I'm a little
cooler?
Too close to the equator.
Because it's
like cold and rainy. And I love like the weather that everybody in Seattle, like that a lot of people who go to Seattle, like they're like, oh, I hate this. That's my weather. I'm like 55 and raining. Give it to me. That's my perfect.
Yeah, it sounds like you need to move to London like stat.
I know, right?
That's like place. Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. I'm pretty sure like 24/7, 365. They don't have their winter is like, it's just rainier or whatever. Like it's not. For sure. It's funny because when you said Seattle and Atlanta, I was like, aren't they both just wet? Isn't that this? Oh, one's hot, wet, one's cold, wet. I get it.
It's a very different kind of wet.
I dig it.
It's just a different. And I'm going to Dublin in December for the improv festival, the Ireland Improv Festival. And I mentioned it to someone I know. I was like, I'm going to Dublin in December. And she looked at me and she was like, oh, Ireland in December. And then immediately her face like changed and she was like, oh, wait, no, that's perfect for you. And I was like, exactly. It's going to be cold and foggy and rainy. I'm signed up. I'm ready for it.
Oh, my God. The cable knit sweaters will be everywhere.
I can't wait.
Oh, my God. It's going to be so great. Oh.
So good.
Yeah. I look forward to the photos. Yeah, that's so cool. I love a good international improv festival. I love those. I love watching them from afar.
Yeah.
Someday I'll go to one, but right now I just like looking at them. That's so funny. So you're in, you went to this smaller town, clearly a college town, because he's working at a college. Yeah. Which path did you take then? Did you find a community that was already there and help out, or did you start your own?
A little bit of both. So I'm now freelancing. So I'm freelancing and just kind of doing my own thing because I have a very particular style of improv that I love. Like I really love the like narrative long form style. And so so I'm doing that here. I've got an unscripted Shakespeare ensemble that we do full improvised plays in the style of Shakespeare. And I just did I do an improvised disaster movie, like a play in the style of a disaster movie called The Day Before Tomorrow, because it's improv and we're all about living in the present. I also have, thank you. I also have, we do an improvised Christmas movie and that's called A Hallmark Family Christmas of a Lifetime. So, and nice. That's just straight up in the style of a, you know, corny Christmas movie. We even did one in July. We did a Christmas in July this year because it's been such a popular show. So
they do it.
Yeah, so
Hallmark
stuff like
does
that.
It.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? That's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Ugh.
If they can do it,
I'd reach out for them to sponsor us, but I'm sure that they would instead just like give us a cease and desist. So I'm just not going to say anything.
I don't know. So, they're pretty good about trying to connect with fans for real. I mean, keep in mind, like, I think I did a commercial recently. I think it was for Hallmark. And I know it's weird to not know, but it was one of those where, like, you're not really talking about the product. You're just doing a thing, and it's the background for whatever they're going to say. I didn't really, you know, I don't know exactly what it was for. it's fine. We were talking about that show One Calls the Heart, which is a Hallmark show, and it's like very, you know, warm-hearted. Everyone's just super sweet. And the woman, Lori Loughlin, who got involved with the college thing was like
right.
in it. And they had to deal with that like storm of insanity coming at them with like total PR insanity. And they handled it. They really did. They were like, you know, took care of what they needed to do, separated ways, said, hey, man, we're just Hallmark. We're super sweet. Don't worry about us. And so, hey, all I'm saying is they seem real nice. I bet you they'd love to give you some cash.
Cool.
Who knows where their corporate office is? I mean, plus, you're near.
Yeah,
I don't mean to cut off your story about your thing and start going down a weird rabbit hole, but that's, I guess, kind of who I am. But I'll bring it back to this idea. The community that you're in, are you like working with, because I hear that Atlanta is like the cool new Hollywood, right? They're doing tons of films
it's
and stuff.
True.
Are you working with a lot of film actors?
I am not a ton, but I do some improv for actors classes and I do some other classes that are specifically advanced improv, like various scene study classes where if an actor has had any training in improv, then they can just jump into those. And they've told me that it really helps with their auditions, you know, when they're taking like my advanced scene study or my scene doctor classes, that it's helped them just be more comfortable improvising on set or for auditions when the casting director is asking them to do that kind of thing, which, you know, I'm sure that so that's not news to you, but
I do a lot of commercial acting, so they're not really asking for too much improv, but
they
do that. It's so funny when you're the person who has to say the like $5.99 for this and they're like, hey, like if you want to do some improv, like that'd be cool. I'm like, what am I improvising? I have to tell the audience what the cost is. Like, so funny. My line is the one that sells your I can't change my line. Okay, sure. Like, if you want me to change my vibe, just tell me. What am I, happy, sad? Give me an emotion name. So funny. Well, that's the weird thing about commercials. That being said, I have seen some really amazing commercial actors take a line that I would consider so bland and turn it into the most interesting thing I've ever seen. So clearly, maybe I'm doing it wrong. I don't do that many. Maybe that's why. But your group is clearly benefiting from it. And I think that's probably, I mean, if they're auditioning for film and they're trying to find a character that they're going to play in this film, yeah, it's absolutely going to help them because they can play with it. They can put something in front of the casting director that's maybe a little different or at least more fleshed out. That's the beauty of improv. I think it exercises a part of your brain that allows you to like just quickly put together information as opposed to like, I hear a lot of actors talk about like the process and they like do all this research and they like read things and they think things and they like try to think about this person. And I appreciate the long-term work, but sometimes I think in improv, we're kind of teaching you how to do that in 30 seconds. Like it's like, what's this person's full life? Go. Okay. Now just be it. Like that's
it. So many people are so afraid of taking an improv class. Even actors are afraid of taking an improv class. And so one of the things that I tell people, and I think it's because improv has a reputation and it's all misrepresentation, right? So what I tell people is that there is this myth about improv that improv is thinking fast on your feet. And I'm like, that is not true. What improv is responding quickly in the moment. So like, please don't think about it as thinking. Pardon the pun. Don't have it in mind as like you're thinking. Don't feel that it's a thinking thing. Know that it's a response thing. It's all about emotional response. So if you're just open in the moment, then you're good. Because you do it all the time, every day of your life.
Yeah.
But some people don't. And if that's the case, then an improv class will also help them be more open in life. And be more emotionally available then as well.
Yeah, so, and like see what's happening in the world, like as a maybe even tap into that storytelling. You know, adult life, I started out teaching adults, and I find the most interesting thing about adults is it's like I'm trying to break off the crust from them and reveal to them the sweet, kind person that they are. And I actually think that's why the stigma for improv. I don't think it has anything to do with the end result of what happens, though I'm sure there's a few people making fun of like legitimately bad improv shows. But there's, I think it's because of the positivity. Because anytime a person, it's like there's this whole culture of uncool, or the culture of cool is to hate everything, right? Somehow. And I'm like, that stinks. I don't want to hate everything. I'd like to like at least one or two things. And I feel like the new like sort of niche world that we're in right now, where it's like you're allowed to love whatever you want, love it hard. There's a whole group of people that want to meet you and they're on the internet. Go be friends with them. And that's great. And I think that breaks it. But for a while, certainly the 80s and 90s, it was very like, be rough and tough. And that's the coolest thing. Are you having the worst day of your life? You're so cool. I mean, you're like, what? I don't understand. So when this group comes through and they're like, you know what, guys, our hearts are big and we're going to love each other and we're going to do a great show. They're like, nope, get me out of here. Who's that happy person? Happy's crap. Everybody knows you have to be depressed to be a comedian. I mean, literally, I've watched more than my fair share of documentaries about comedians who are like, it really matters that I'm depressed. I have to be super sad to get it done. Like, you're like, ugh. So then improv and its positivity becomes not so legitimate to comedy. And then it's mostly stand-ups because they're louder who are saying bad things about improv. That's
true.
My soapbox, and I'm putting it away now.
If you look at the, not before I stand on it.
Yeah, all right.
If you look at what that's rooted in, though, like if you go back and you say, well, why is it that this person or these people are being negative about this and they're afraid of the positivity or they're bad-mouthing it? And it's like, well, the reason that they're saying this is uncool and the reason that they're saying, you know, this isn't great or this is dumb is they're trying to avoid their vulnerability and getting out in front of it. It's like when you insult yourself before anybody else can insult you. It's like, okay, well, if I go ahead and say that this isn't cool, then I don't have to be vulnerable. And then I'm safe, you know?
Yeah.
So, and it's just cracking that. And there's this, when I was teaching at the Second City, one of the classes that I taught, because we had started a program while I was there, and it was specifically our beginning improv program, but for adults with severe social anxiety. So the students in the class met twice a week. They met once with me as their teacher, just through a regular class, but then they met once in group therapy with their therapist. And they would talk about, like, how is this how is this affecting our lives? And is it giving us any, is it lessening or, you know, heightening our social anxiety? And the thing that was awesome about teaching those classes is that because everybody knew their vulnerability, like their vulnerability was out in the open because they had signed up for this class together. So they were all going to group therapy together. So there was no, there were no like barriers or walls that they had built up on the first day that I had to like try to help them knock down. Like they were just vulnerable from day one. And it was one of the most amazing beginning improv classes to teach. And it wasn't just like that one class. It was every time that I taught the social anxiety, you know, improv class, it was always like, they know their vulnerability, so they're not going to try to hide it from each other. And it was like the best kind of stuff.
Wow. That's so great. I really love that you guys even had that and that was available. Plus, the idea of group therapy is like, now I feel like every improv troupe needs to go to group therapy together.
I know, right?
Do you want to do this?
A lot of problems.
I mean, well, honestly, to a certain extent, I mean, in my mind, it's kind of like, it's kind of like an actor for the movies going to the gym. If you want to be in Mission Impossible 6 or whatever, you need to work out. Like you gotta, the auditions for that are mostly, can you jump from this to that? They're going to be 17 days where you're going to run 8 hours a day. Is that fine? Like, yeah, it is. Great. That's your skill. That's the kind of crowd you're on. If you want to be an improviser and totally get super deep, man, group therapy, super connecting, literally having a psychologist help you connect even more. Okay.
Right.
My other question, because I'm like so fascinated with it by this, is was there at least like a psychological paper written about this? Like, is there some sort of like study and not without names or whatever, just sort of like the psychologists, like what they learned over this time? Because like, I feel like that's a book I want to read too. I want to read your improv history book and I want to read this psychologist's like how improv can help social anxiety book. Like, so amazing.
That's a good question. I imagine that maybe somebody, I'm not sure if there was a paper written on it, but I know that in the class we met with the therapist before we started teaching, because that particular therapist wanted to get info from us, like how do we run our classes and what are our, so we all met with him, and then he came in and met with me on the last day. That was when we first started getting the program up and running.
So awesome.
Then I taught more, and I don't think I met with him again, but we did have papers that we would have them fill out where they would like rank their anxiety level for certain things, like having a phone conversation. What is your anxiety level? Going to the store, meeting a friend, going to a party. And they would rank all of those before the 8 weeks had started. And then they would rank them again after the 8 weeks class had ended, and they had all gone down, which was really amazing. And they could write their own comments, so they could write their own comments, you know, just like essay format, you know, kind of anything else you want to say. And it was very positive, you know, it had really changed their lives, which was kind of amazing, you know.
Awesome.
I mean, you, as an improv teacher, as someone who lives and breathes improv, you kind of take it for granted sometimes, of like, oh yeah, of course it's going to change their life. And then I'm like, oh my God, why am I thinking like it? You know what I mean? Like I need to like take a moment and be in the present and just really appreciate what's happening. It's beautiful. And I'm like, oh, of course it's good.
You're like a surgeon who finishes like a life-saving thing and is like, all right, what's next? Or like, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. You're like, what?
Yeah.
Can we appreciate this for 2 seconds? Mr. Harris is alive.
Yeah. I know. I love it.
How long did you work at the Second City in Chicago?
I was there for like 6.5 years. So I lived in Chicago for about seven and a half years. Before that I was in Seattle for 9 years.
Now, did you get there and just get a teaching job, or did you like take the classes and then get a teaching job?
A little bit of both. So when I first moved to Chicago, I had been improvising for over 15 years when I first moved to Chicago, and I'd been teaching as well. But I signed up. So within the first couple of weeks of moving to Chicago, I was signed up for the program, program at IO, the year-long kind of improv doodly-doo program. And then I had also signed up for Second City Conservatory year-long program, which is their like improv to sketch program, where you create a sketch review. And I had gotten on a little improv team at one of the other theaters. And then within a couple months, I was teaching at a theater, but not the Second City. And about halfway through my time as a student at Second City, I applied to teach for their youth and teen program, because they needed teachers. And I had been teaching, you know, youth and teen for a while, not as much adults. And then, so I started teaching them. And then I started also, 6 months after that, I started teaching for their adult program at Second City. So I was very fortunate, because it's kind of hard to get in as a teacher there.
Yeah.
They're very, because of their reputation, they're very picky. Yeah. And they're very defensive about, you know, in fact, when I got hired as a youth and teen teacher, because I love teaching all ages. But the interviewer was like, I have to let you know that this is not like a glide path into teaching for the adult program. And I was like, oh, no, it's okay. He's like, because sometimes people, you know, they want to teach here and then they don't care about the kids. They just want to teach for, you know, they just want to say that they're teaching classes at Second City for adults. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not. I mean, I wanted to teach there too, but when I started teaching adults, I was still teaching youth and teen. So until I moved. So.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a special kind of person that's going to like open themselves up to talking to kids, because I don't know at what point in your adulthood you switch over and you immediately think that everyone under 18 is like worthless, but that happens. And I really see it in people, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
They're fine. Like they'll be like, are they even funny? And you're like, yeah, they're real funny.
Oh,
like,
my
what?
God, they're hilarious.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's like, they're not funny the way I'm funny, but I'm also like 30 years older than them or something. Like, they don't need to, you know, I just go, what do you, the first day I always go, what do you guys watch? What are you consuming? What comedy are you into? And then mm-hmm. I write it all down and try to focus whatever, because I teach like camps. So I try to give them what they like. So it's like, okay, great. You want to do that kind of stuff? Great. Let's work on this. You know, they'll say slapstick and I'll be like, you know, that means like falling and stuff and like a lot of physical jokes. And they're like, yeah. And I go, all right, cool. And so then we'll do that stuff and we'll do, you know, all sorts of whatever they think is funny. There were entire scenes this summer where I'm like, I don't know what's funny right here, but they laughed every time. So I was like, well,
right. Sounds like they make these references and you're like, I don't know what ref. They teach me so many things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I heard about they parodied. Oh, what's that one that came out this summer? Oh, that Old Town Road song that was like some kid made it and then it went like platinum overnight. And he like went from like hanging out, you know, in high school to like being famous in 3 seconds. Yeah. I had never heard the song. I mean, I heard about the kid cause it was like, whoa, that's cool. But that I'd never heard the song, and then all of a sudden they're doing this song in one of the scenes and everyone laughs, and I was like, oh no, he did a good job, don't laugh at him. And they're like, no, he's making fun of this other song. And I was like, what is the song? Like, they have to explain stuff to me, and they're so sweet,
so
they do it. But yeah, I don't
and
know.
They love when they get to explain stuff to you, because there's not a lot of places in their world where they have adults that are saying, can you please explain this to me?
Oh yeah.
So absolutely. They really appreciate that you get to be that, you know what I mean? Like, it's a really nice, it's similar to, one of the things I do for my improv to sketch class is I give them journals and I let them awesome. Know, I'm like, I'm going to read these, so don't write anything in here that you don't want me to read.
Exactly. Know your audience, number one.
But I have them list out, like, I'm like, you have to fill a page. I'm like, fill a page of things that you love, fill a different page of things that you hate, fill a different page of things that are important to you, fill a different page of things that have changed since you. If they're high school students, I'm like, since you entered high school, like, what is different for you right now from when you entered high school? And that usually gets kind of some cool stuff. And then those are the suggestions that I use for all of their improv. So I never give them a suggestion from my brain. I go to their notebooks and I give them suggestions, because I'm not going to say your suggestion. Right. Because I'm not going to say your suggestion for the scene is vaping in the bathroom, because I'm not going to think about that. But, like, literally three of them wrote things that they hate is vaping in the bathroom.
I love it.
So now they have this awesome sketch about vaping in the bathroom. Do you know what I mean?
God,
like,
I
never would have come from me.
Makes me think of the song Smoking in the Boys' Room. Like, vaping in the bathroom.
It's the Gen Z version, vaping in the bathroom.
Yeah. Honestly, the other thing about kids, and tell me if you feel the same, but even just talking to them makes me feel better about the world. Like, I'm like, oh, we're going to be okay.
It's part of my self-care therapy, honestly.
Yeah.
Just to have them every week. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Like, it's like, if you watch too much CNN, at least once a week, ask a 10-year-old what they would do to change the world. And their answers will be so pure and so wonderful. And you'll know they might do it. And that is all
it's
I
true.
Need. Like, they'll be like, I don't know why everyone keeps fighting and is mean to each other. And they're like, yeah, that's true. And I was like, oh, are we really having this conversation right now? Okay. Like, it's so funny. And different groups, like high school, they're more like, they're older, so they're a little bit more nervous around each other, but they have bigger ideas and they feel they can do those. Whereas, like, middle schoolers, I find, are a little bit more distant from the I can change the world, but they have wild imaginings, which are great and actually will later be helpful in the world. And it's like, yeah, keep thinking that kind of stuff, because that'll help you. When you're 50, that idea will be the best idea you've ever had. Like... and they just make me feel so good about the world. I feel like, because they'll be in charge someday. I also say, like, they'll be in charge when I'm old, when I'm in my 80s and I'm wherever I am, Florida, let's be honest, then then, like, that's who's gonna be the people in charge. They're the senators, they're the, you know, and they seem good. And don't get me wrong, we're clearly dealing with the sweetest, kindest, loveliest people because they're taking theater classes. So there's that. But they're still wonderful,
you know,
and I do love them.
Like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, are they sweet? You know what I mean? Like, I think also the theater is bringing it out of them too. So it's helping them connect with that empathy. To go back to empathy.
Totally. So we're nearing the end of our chat. I want to ask you one final question. It might be a little weird, so take your time to figure out what it might be. Because I just thought of this, and I thought, because I was thinking about the kids and how they're, like, saving the world. And also about the idea that sometimes when you're younger, like, you don't realize to, like, keep track of mistakes so that you can learn from them even later. Like, there are things that I did in my life that I think about now that it's like 20 years later, but that'll teach me a lesson now that I needed, you know? So my question is, and feel free, like I said, take a second to think about this. Is there a moment or an event or something that happened in your life that at the time you thought was terrible and you didn't enjoy it, but later you realized was actually good and provided you a lesson or another opportunity, like a door closed but another one opened, something like that, where at the time you're like, no, I don't want to do this, but it turned out to be something really good?
Specifically, I can't think of something that, like, this moment, but I think just generally, and this is something I actually did a solo show about this, where I did a one-woman show that was about my journey as a performer, as an improviser, and, like, my relationship with improv and how it's changed and evolved from when I started, when I was, like, 14 years old, when I took my first class, to, like, now. And when I started, I was a 14-year-old, so I was like, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to get on Saturday Night Live, and then I'm going to be in the movies. And then Mr. T is going to be my bodyguard, and that's going to happen. Of course, spoiler alert, that did not happen. But I do have Mr. T's autograph that I got in the 80s. And bonus, I found out that I did all this other improv stuff and other stuff that wasn't improv that I never would have done, that I found, you know, like, it's just one of those things where you realize that the journey you went on was totally different than what you expected, but it was way better than anything you could have imagined. So I, for example, did a couple of solo shows, which I never thought that I, you know, had like the ovaries to do, but I totally did them. And I did like a bunch of puppet stuff for a while. And I've gotten into storytelling, which I absolutely love. And my relationship with teaching and directing, I love that. Like, that's something that I always thought I just wanted to be on stage and a performer. But teaching and directing is amazing. There's a motorcycle. That's the mistake that I regret. It's his mistake of driving them. I don't know if that's on the thing. I'm sorry.
You're fine.
But it's just a reminder. It's like Zen and the art of motorcycle interruptions. It's just my reminder to be present. That's all that is. So I don't even know if you heard it, but I was like real distracted by it.
Yep.
Okay, good. Sorry. Because I'm outside because I was in the library. So I was like, well, I can't do this interview in the library because that would be rude. But yeah, so
I've done interviews in the library, like in person with people.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love that.
I know it's a weird question, but it's just recently I've become obsessed with this idea that, like, you know, sometimes hard times happen and things aren't going well. And so I try to stay focused and keep myself vigilantly looking around for what the lesson is. Like, I'm like, wow, I don't like this. This is not my enjoyment. But I'm like, okay, if I'm not having a good time, that means that the world is trying to teach me something. So let's see what's happening. Like, what can I learn from this? And even if it's not super direct where, you know, I'm going to be honest, I don't know if I could answer the question, but like, it's just the idea is, in my mind, is that there are some tough times that a lot of times it's hard to get through. I think the other part is that, you know, we have this like hindsight. They say hindsight is 20/20, but I also say hindsight has rose-colored glasses, right? Because you look back and you're like, oh, but that's all right. See, at the end of the day, and you're like, yeah, but for 2 years you lived in that apartment and hated those roommates. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, whatever it was or whatever situation where it was like, well, you had to move 6 months in because blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, right, I forgot about that terrible thing that I had to do or that I did or blah, blah, blah. You know, and then you move forward from it. So it can be tough. But, you know, certainly when I'm having a creative block, when I don't know what to do, I will try to, you know, focus on, well, what can I be learning? Perhaps while I can't create, I can certainly shore up some education so that when I finally have that creative flow again, I'll have some ideas going. When your students have a creative block, what kind of advice do you give them?
I mean, there was one time that I asked them, I mean, I say this a lot, that if they do something on stage, I tell them not to should on themselves, and I'll enunciate that very clearly so this can go on the radio. Don't should on yourself.
Yes.
Because I think that a lot of times we can get in that mindset of, oh, well, why didn't I do that? I should have done this and da 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 da. And I say, you know what? It's just you've done it. You've experienced it. Now you know what it's like, but you can move on. And it's not like this thing that you have to dwell on. And there was one time where I was in class with them and they had done something and they had said something to me and I was like in teacher mind. So I like wasn't listening to them and I was thinking about something that had just happened and I was making a note about it. So I said to them, oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I was not listening to you. Can you repeat that? I was like, I'm sorry. I wasn't. And because I apologized for the third time. And they were like, Miss Amanda, no, don't apologize. Don't shit on yourself. You learned something. I was like, okay, I deserve that. So they were great. But yeah, I think that that's like kind of the main advice I give. But two, when I also don't want, I find value in the, what can I learn from this right now? But I also don't want to put pressure on someone like, you have to squeeze out something positive in this moment.
Oh,
as
no,
opposed to maybe the yes and is, yes, I'm going through something terrible. And it is inspiring me to change X, Y, or Z to try to get out of it or try to stop it or try to whatever. And then maybe I can find something positive, you know, a week later, a month later, a year later.
It's more like inspiration. Like, what does it get you to do? You know, like, how did you were forced to, I was forced to go home to Boston. And when I had to go home to Boston, it forced me to find a job there. And then that led to this, da, da, da. You know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, cool.
Like, you know what I mean? Certain troubling times, like I've had to move more than my fair share of times because I could no longer afford to do it. Like I had lost a job or something and I had to move out from my roommates. And then I hated it at the time, but it was like, well, thank goodness I moved on to the next thing because then this job happened and that thing. So yeah, I mean, in the moment, never, I can never find it.
Right.
But I just try to give myself the sort of suggestion, you know, like a little personal hug of myself to say, don't worry, it's all right. You'll figure it out. You'll get past
this. Yeah, it's so important too, because it's also, I mean, the first step is just validating that what you're feeling is okay. It's like, it's okay to feel like this is kind of bad, you know, and it's okay to be sad about it. And it's okay to not be okay, you know, like they say. And then, yeah, like personal hug, you know, and then like, where are we going to be with this tomorrow? Who knows? But like, don't, but it sort of is what it is, right? So there's no sense in wishing that it wasn't what it was.
Yeah.
It's just like accepting the reality that, okay, this is what it is now. So what am I going to do with this reality so that I can be as happy as I can be in this situation, which is, sounds like this is another way of saying what you're saying.
Well, who knows? I mean, I'm also heavily neurotic as well, so who knows if I'm working it out. I find I can teach all right, but my own personal figuring it out, well, I don't know. I also have a 2-year-old, so I'm kind of I'm always a little intense because my brain's going 1,000 places
at
once.
A whole other space. Yeah.
It's amazing. A life experience I'm trying to log because I feel like it's a good one. I should have it. I'm like, oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Is that what this everyone was talking about?
It's constantly changing, right? Like it's constantly, like as soon as you're an expert on a 2-year-old, then they're going to be 3 and you're going to be like,
Oh yeah.
I'm not an expert.
I don't know that I've ever been an expert.
Now.
Yeah. I don't know that at any point I'm an expert. I'm just trying to listen. That's it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Gosh. Listen, Amanda, thank you so much for being on the podcast, for chatting with me, for sharing all your great stories and everything. I feel like we talked so much about philosophy in this one. But I feel good about it. Thank you for being on the show.
It was such a delight. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. Maybe I hope to one day meet you either in Austin or Atlanta or some place in the part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Texas.
London.
Who knows? Ooh, London, right? Let's make a plan. Ooh.
Right?
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.